Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Across Iraq today, after yesterday's bombing of the revered Shiite mosque in the city of Samarra, the Iraqi government has ordered a curfew and is canceling all leaves for soldiers and police. Sunni politicians are pulling out of the talks aimed at forming a coalition government. Hundreds of Sunni mosques have been targeted in reprisal attacks, and more than 100 people, including some prominent Sunni clerics and children, have been killed. One of Iraq's vice presidents compared the mosque attack to 9/11 in the U.S. Jonathan Feiner is foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. He joins us from Baghdad. And Jonathan, first, give us some context. Have you ever seen anything like this in your time in Iraq?
I would say that in the 9 months or so that I've spent in Baghdad, this is certainly among the tensest days, if not the tensest, at least in terms of sectarian tension between rival Sunni and Shiite Muslim sects here in the capital, especially. Things are particularly tight. Streets were more or less empty as the government called for a holiday in mourning for the mosque that was destroyed. But attacks took place throughout the city and throughout the country from last night into early this morning.
Well, today's Financial Times is quoting a U.S. official who says they're under instructions from the Bush administration to not use the phrase civil war. But we're hearing that some Iraqi officials are using that phrase. First of all, what are you hearing, and what's your sense of what it is?
A civil war is a hard thing to define. It looks different in probably every context in every country where one has ever taken place. And it's certainly, there's been a long period of time when people were reluctant to use that phrase here in Iraq, given that while there were many people being killed, the numbers certainly didn't measure up to the previous conflicts that were called civil war in other parts of the world. Now, given the high level of tension, the high number of casualties, it is a phrase that people are using with greater frequency, although, as you say, not U.S. diplomats and not most government officials, although some have started to refer to the situation that way.
Well, and we should point out as well that 4 U.S. soldiers have also died in the last day from a roadside bomb. But what is the role in the U.S. military in Iraq right now in the middle of this conflict? Are they standing back, coming more forward to help quell the violence? What's going on?
What we hear from the military is that to a large extent they're leaving the provision of security in some of these hotspots to the Iraqi security forces, and that the U.S. Soldiers are playing, for the most part, a supporting role in that effort. This is all part of the broader attempt to transfer responsibility over security to the Iraqis, which is going to be really a significant part of what goes on this year as the U.S. tries to scale back the numbers of its troops.
Jonathan, any sense of how well that's going to go, given that we heard reports yesterday of Shiite policemen in particular in their uniforms protesting the bombing?
It's beyond just protesting the bombing. There are allegations also that in at least one southern city in Basra, there were police actually involved in one of the clashes with people from a Sunni political office there. The perception of Iraq's police and army is very much one of sectarians that supports the Shiites at the expense of the Sunnis. So for them to overcome that, it's going to take more sort of careful work on the part of the security forces than has been exhibited in some places so far.
What are people saying on the street? Are you able to go out?
Yeah, we spent a bit of time out in Baghdad today talking to people. For the most part, I would say, depending on the neighborhood, there is a lot of optimism that this will calm down eventually, that things are about as bad as they've ever been in the post-war Iraq, or at least since the U.S. invasion in 2003, in terms of tension. But there is a lot of optimism that this will go back to the relative calm and relative lack of tension that was present just a week ago. But it's important to remember that things weren't great before all this happened, and things will continue to be difficult here for a very long time.
And Jonathan, yesterday there was some speculation that because this Shiite mosque is so revered by Shia around the world, that there might be an influx of pilgrims coming in to defend their holy building. Have there been reports of that, people trying to cross the border, people trying to come into the country from outside?
We haven't heard of people coming into the country from outside. We have heard of people from around Iraq getting on buses, getting into cars, and driving, making their way to Samarra. We're expecting a big turnout at Friday prayers in mosque in Samarra tomorrow as a sort of show of support for the people there in this difficult time. But that also, is a potentially inflammatory situation to have so many people from other places making their way there in an attempt to sort of show support.
Jonathan Feiner, foreign correspondent for The Washington Post, speaking to us from Baghdad. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Here in Massachusetts, the issue of gay adoption has bubbled up as the Catholic Church tries to prevent gay parents from adopting children through the church group Catholic Charities. But as an article this week in USA Today points out, gay adoption is an issue in 16 states. The paper describes these moves to ban gay adoption as the second front in the culture wars that began during the 2004 elections. Well, we want to take a few minutes to focus on gay adoptions today, and we'll have more on the politics in a moment. But first, Ohio is on the front line of this issue. Some state lawmakers are proposing a total ban on gay adoptions and foster parenting, which would make Ohio only the second state in the nation, besides Florida, to enact a total ban. Joining us on the line now is Greg Quinlan. He's the founder and president of the Pro Family Network, which is based in Ohio. And Greg, we understand you first introduced this issue to Ohio lawmakers. Why? What inspired you?
Well, what inspired me was the success of the Florida law, which was appealed through, went through the court system, went through the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, U.S., was upheld, then was appealed to the United States Supreme Court, where Justice Kennedy decided not to hear it, giving it cert. So that was the time to move. Here in Ohio, we passed through a constitutional amendment where 3.3 million people voted in favor of marriage between one man, one woman, recognizing no other union and no other resemblance of any other union other than marriage between one man and one woman. It seemed logical to take that to the next step.
So you were inspired by the fact that your state and other states passed bans on gay marriage.
Correct. You know, as an ex-gay, I also believe that, homosexuality is incompatible with parenting. The children should not be in that home environment. So that's why I thought it was the best thing to do. This is where we need to now take the definition of family, which is the definition of marriage, and make sure those children are placed within that definition.
Well, now we want to, you know, be clear here, because Ohio, we understand, currently allows single gay people to adopt. Is that correct?
Actually, no. What it does is allow single parents to adopt with no opposition to homosexuals adopting.
Okay. Well, 10 Ohio lawmakers have signed on to your bill. What's your sense of how much support you have in the legislature?
Well, the Speaker of the Ohio House is now against it. He himself is adopted, although he wasn't adopted into a homosexual environment. So I don't understand his opposition here, and it is causing him already some problems within his district. He's getting a lot of heat from his own constituents, so he may need to rethink his position. But as we did with the Defense of Marriage Act in Ohio, I also was the one that got that first introduced. It took us 8 years from the time we first introduced it to the time the governor signed it into law, and we're willing to take the long trip to get this passed.
Well, and Greg, you've cited your personal feelings and research that backs your position, but groups, as you know, such as the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Child Welfare League of America, disagree with you. They say adoptive children raised by gay or lesbian parents fare as well as those raised in heterosexual homes, and many advocates say gay parents are often the only parents available for abused adoptive children. And I just wonder, with all of that information, why wouldn't you be in favor of it? Have you seen a gay adoptive parents who haven't performed well?
Absolutely. Oh, yes, we have. And we have people ready to testify who grew up in homosexual environments who say that they have suffered because of it. We also have homosexuals currently out and open, gays and lesbians, willing to testify that they raised their children in that environment and they are sorry that they did. They've actually apologized to their own children. I want to get back to the statistics you mentioned.
Just a few
and
seconds.
Organizations you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
8 seconds. There are members within those organizations that do not agree with the statement position that their organizations have taken. In fact, there's been quite a groundswell within their membership to change those positions.
Greg Quinlan, founder and president of the Ohio-based Pro Family Network. He introduced legislation in Ohio to ban all gay adoptions and foster parenting in that state. Greg, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We want to turn now to Paula Wisniewski. She's director of adoption services for the Home for Little Wanderers here in Boston. And Paula, you're currently directly involved with gay parents. What do you think about what Greg just said about their ability to raise children?
Well, I think it's a shame. It's a very sad commentary. We here at the home have worked with numerous gay and lesbian families who have provided for our children exceptionally. They're meeting their children's needs in every way. Our children are doing well emotionally, cognitively, socially. And I really don't understand how sexual orientation factors into one's capacity to nurture a child.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, if I'm wondering if there would be a way to compare, and there might be a certain percentage of gay parents who have problems raising children as there is a percentage of heterosexual parents who have problems raising children.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I think, first of all, you know, many of our families, our gay and lesbian families who are adopting children, are adopting some of the most traumatized, needy children.
And by the way, why is that? Because we hear that from many agencies that, in fact, the gay community takes in children that most people don't want.
Well, I think the reality is that the other avenues that people can adopt include international adoption and domestic infant adoption and adopting children from the foster care system. And at this time, international adoption, there are many countries that, you know, aren't open to placing children in gay and lesbian homes. And in domestic adoption, it is the birth families that choose the adoptive family, and there is increasingly becoming more birth parents open to gay and lesbian families as there is more research done that demonstrates gays and lesbians provide well for children.
We understand also that, for instance, Catholic Charities, which is the Catholic group here in Boston, which is in the middle of its own conflict because the Catholic Church does not want children to be adopted by gay parents, many people there from there have told us that the gay and particularly lesbian families are sometimes the only families that certain children can go to. For instance, a home where there is no man in the home if a child's been traumatized.
Well, certainly I think that's true. Some of our kids have been hurt, and to place them into an environment that represents the environment they came from, that they were traumatized in, could definitely be a bad thing. So certainly that is at times the most appropriate placement. But I think that, you know, it's more than that. I think I would go even further and say that I feel that some of our gay and lesbian families are better prepared to adopt children and be what I refer to as therapeutic parents to these children. I think there's a lot of similarities between being a non-traditional family and being an adopted person or adopted child. You know, there's experience with, you know, not quite fitting in and having dealt with adversity and prejudice and loss. And, you know, just I think also oftentimes children who are adopted are automatically pathologized and so are gay and lesbian families as Greg did. So it's I think that our adoptive families are especially talented and gifted at raising adopted children and helping them to become, you know, emotionally and cognitively and socially well off.
In fact, we're reminded in the 80s when gay and lesbians were the only ones taking in children who had HIV and AIDS, and mm-hmm. agencies were looking the other way because it was felt that people who had been marginalized were better able to care for children who were being marginalized. Mm-hmm. Paula Wisniewski is Director of Adoption Services for the Home for Little Wanderers. That's here in Boston, Massachusetts. Paula, thank you.
Thank you.
And just ahead, we'll speak with a reporter about how this battle is unfolding across the country. Also later in the show, the Senate is debating port security. We'll get the latest. Much more coming up here and now. Efforts in 16 states to ban gay adoption. Currently, the only state where gay adoption is totally banned is Florida. Well, we turn now to Andrea Stone, correspondent for USA Today, who wrote the story in this week's newspaper. And Andrea, you described this as the second front in the culture wars. How so?
Well, there are a lot of fronts in the culture wars, but in terms of what, when it comes to gays and lesbians, in 2004, 11 states had ballot initiatives banning same-sex marriage. All of them passed, and it was thought by a lot of political analysts that these referendums really helped to drive conservative voters to the polls, and helping President Bush to win re-election in some key states, specifically Ohio, but certainly in other states where the voting was close. Conservative Christian groups are saying that children are best raised by a mother and a father, or if not that, at least a, you know, heterosexual single person. Both sides claim research to back their view. conservatives say that children are best raised in a home with a mother and a father, and gay and lesbians, as well as adoption groups, child welfare groups, the American Academy of Pediatrics say, research says that they're really the children who are raised by gay and lesbian parents fare no worse than those in straight households. So, you know, I don't think they're going to be agreeing on that anytime soon.
Well, here in Boston, it's the Catholic Church that's moving to ban gay adoptions by trying to circumvent a state law against discrimination. And by the way, we're told members of the board of the Catholic Charities here will resign next week if the church continues to try to push that. But what is happening nationally? Is this a nationally organized campaign backed by Christian groups, conservative groups, Catholic groups? What's going on?
I'm not sure that it's national in the fact that some of the groups who are here in Washington, the big groups, are behind this. They say that they're still working on the marriage issue. You know, Congress has still not passed a same-sex amendment to the Constitution, so they want to focus on that. But there is, that does seem to be in the individual states, and I've identified at least 16 states where there's at least some nascent movement to do this. After all, adoption, like other family matters, do come under state jurisdiction versus the federal government. So, and as does marriage. So that's why the action is in individual states right now.
Well, in fact, you remind us of states where adoption has already been banned or curtailed. Tell us about that.
Well, Florida is the only state where all gays and lesbians, whether they're single or couples, cannot adopt, or however they can be foster parents. And you might recall a couple of years ago there was a court challenge that entertainer Rosie O'Donnell was involved in. I spoke with her for the story. She is a registered foster parent in Florida and has four adopted children, including one that was conceived by her partner. A couple of other states, I mean, the states' laws vary, and they are really discretionary in many ways, but Mississippi bans joint adoptions by gay couples, whereas a single person who happens to be gay could adopt under certain circumstances. And Utah prohibits all unmarried couples, whether they're straight or gay, from adopting.
And what about Ohio? What is the law there?
In Ohio, couples cannot adopt jointly. However, they can adopt singly. And I talked to one couple who went to Oregon to adopt their son because they felt they'd been together for now 25 years, and they felt that they were going to be raising this child jointly, and they wanted to adopt jointly, so they went to Oregon.
Well, will you remind us when you tell these personal stories that this isn't a new issue? We're reminded of the presidential campaign where Mike Dukakis from here in Massachusetts was running, and there was a story in this state in Massachusetts where it became known that a child had been adopted in Massachusetts by a gay couple. There was thinking on the part of a lot of people involved in adoptions that it had long been sort of the secret of adoptions that gay couples were adopting children who were difficult to adopt, that there was sort of a wink and a nod about it.
I think that's very true. I was speaking to a gay activist in Georgia who was saying that it's really up to judges and their discretion, and that people go sort of judge shopping, if you will, because they know some judges will allow it and some won't. So it's really very discretionary.
And aren't some agencies looking the other way, knowing that it's more important?
I think they're doing more than looking the other way. They're actually endorsing gays and gay and lesbian adoption. I mean, I spoke to people, the Child Welfare League of America and another national adoption groups who said, we favor, this is not a gay issue. Like marriage, many people saw that as sort of the sanctity of marriage was being attacked, and this was very different than this because this involves children. And in fact, I interviewed the Speaker of the Ohio House, who's a conservative Republican, and who 2 years ago was in favor of legislation banning gay marriage in Ohio, and he himself was adopted as a child, and he says this is not a gay issue, this is about children. And I think that that's where a lot of the child welfare, the adoption groups come down. We're talking about children who don't have parents, who are in foster care, who need a stable home situation. And, so it's not just, what two people want to do in the bedroom. It's really about, many of these children in foster care, have been abused and have been sort of languishing there for a long time. And so I think that child welfare officials in many states and adoption agencies say, look, it's better that they should be you know, have two mothers or two fathers than to have no parents at all.
Andrea Stone, correspondent for USA Today. Andrea, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Quick note on another story we're following today. South Dakota may soon become the first state in 14 years to start a direct legal attack on a woman's right to abortion. Yesterday, lawmakers voted to approve a law that outlaws nearly all abortions other than those to save the life of the mother. The bill contains no exception for incest or rape. The bill, which was passed by the House 2 weeks ago and then changed slightly by the Senate, needs to be approved by both houses and then requires the signature of Governor Mike Rounds. The governor has said he will not comment on whether he will sign the measure until it reaches his desk. Supporters want the ban to be a test case to try to overturn Roe v. Wade now that President Bush has appointed two conservative justices to the court. Opponents of the ban, including representatives from Planned Parenthood, are calling the ban unconstitutional and are vowing to sue to block the law from going into effect, a process that could tie it up for years. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program
quell criticism over a deal to hand over operations at six major American ports to a company owned by the Dubai government of the United Arab Emirates. At a cabinet meeting this morning, President Bush voiced his strong support for the transfer of port management from a British company to Dubai Ports World.
The more people learn about the transaction that has been scrutinized and approved by my government, the more they'll be comforted that our ports will be secure.
Well, senators were hoping to get some of that information at an Armed Services Committee briefing this morning. Democratic senators blasted the Bush administration for failing to notify Congress of the deal and also noted that top members of government didn't know about it until last week. Here's Senator Hillary Clinton.
We have a decision-making process that did not alert the President, the Secretary of the Treasury, the Secretary of Defense, that several of our most critical ports were about to be transferred to a foreign government entity.
Well, joining us with more now is Greg Hitt of the Wall Street Journal. He covered today's briefings. And, Greg, it seems as if this is a bipartisan complaint that Congress was cut out of the process.
Yes, there has been, well before this hearing, I mean, building now for 10 days or so, a swell of concern that the administration did little, if anything, to keep Congress abreast of this transaction and how it was moving forward.
The Committee on Foreign Investments, or CFIUS, also briefed the Senate today, and CFIUS is the committee that streamlined or shortened the approval process of this deal. Tell us more about that.
Well, the committee, I mean, there's sort of two things going on here. This process works in some ways on two tracks. You have a formal mechanism that requires, when a transaction of this type comes up, that requires a 30-day standard review of the security implications of it. And if something emerges, then the law that is of concern, then the law would require or encourage the government to conduct an additional 45-day investigation that would be deeper and more intensive. The administration counters that in reality, the review was much longer, though, than the 30 days that they did invoke. They note that the company came to the government last fall, well before filing a formal request for an investigation or notice to the government that this transaction was going forward. And so, you know, the Treasury and others in administration say they actually began looking at DP World, which is the company at issue here, in the middle of last fall, which gave them several weeks to investigate before a formal, examination mm-hmm. was triggered.
Well, it seems that another message that the administration is trying to get across, and they've repeated it over and over, is that the United Arab Emirates can be trusted to protect American ports. And it seems as if there's a shift in the defense of the deal to the thinking that anyone who objects is being racist. Deputy Defense Secretary Gordon England assured Congress that the United Arab Emirates is a key ally on the war in terror. He said attempts to stop the deal were motivated by discrimination.
The terrorists want us. They want our nation to become distrustful. They want us to become paranoid and isolationist. And my view is we cannot allow this to happen. It needs to be just the opposite.
Did senators respond to that at all, Greg? You know, this idea that this puts the administration in a sticky wicket of saying to Arabs, we can't do work with you because you're Arabs.
Well, this is a classic struggle here for the, that takes place in Washington, where you have, a debate decided by, or an issue decided by who sets the terms of debate. Early on, the terms of debate on this issue were set by critics. Who framed it around national security concerns and in the context of 9/11. That issue it was not a really a strong ground for the administration to push back on, which is why you have the administration and the president raising the idea that this would be a racist decision to reject it, and trying to steer the focus of conversation onto whether or not this is an Arab country and an Arab company, and so this is a classic struggle here that takes place in Washington over sort of who sets the terms of political debate.
So the president is forced to say that even though Dubai has been a way station for contraband, including nuclear contraband.
Well, it's been a transfer point, and I don't think there's much dispute about that. The arguments that run counter to that are that at the same time that Dubai's got a record here, the U.S. government has its own failings, and certainly the 9/11 hijackers found it easy to come into the United States and live here before that accident happened.
Well, because of the story, many Americans are shocked to find out how many foreign countries run shipping and port issues in different countries. But another major issue is port security in general. Democrats saying today that funding requests from the Coast Guard have gone largely unanswered. What was said about that?
It didn't strike me as a major focus of the hearing, but it is true that there is a debate over how much money has gone to the Coast Guard. On the issue of the security, though, I think there's a larger question here that really is gets obscured in the rhetoric and in some of the hyperbole. A company like this that comes in has a role in providing in security, but is not the exclusive provider of security in these ports. The security is provided by the Coast Guard. Security is provided by Customs, which has agents on the ground and screens packages. And the company, and then there's also security provided by local government officials, port police and such. The company has a responsibility to work with these agencies towards a goal of providing a safety and secure environment, but they don't bear the exclusive responsibility. So some of that is getting lost. That reality is getting lost in the debate.
All right. And Greg Hitta, the Wall Street Journal. Just to be clear, you said that Congress wants to hold up the sale for a 45-day investigative period, but the president has threatened to veto any legislation that would stall or block the sale. So very briefly, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I mean, we're in a standoff at this point. Congress at this point, even though there is a hearing today, is out of session. So the bulk of the 535 members of Congress are out back in their districts or in their home states.
Mm-hmm. They're probably listening to talk radio.
We would hope so.
Where everybody is talking about this topic, so it's going to remain heated up.
So we are in a bit of a standstill until next week when members come back. And, there are some members of Congress, some staffers who are trying to look for a way forward out of this. But right now, we're in a standoff period.
Greg Hitta of the Wall Street Journal talking to us from Washington, where there's a Senate briefing today on the plan to turn over management of major U.S. ports to a Dubai government-owned company. Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, tonight is the night for the marquee event of the Olympics, the women's figure skating long program. 4 minutes of grace, athleticism, tension, they might fall. Going into the event, the USA's Sasha Cohen holds a lead over Russian world champion Irina Slutskaya and Japan's Shizuku Arakawa. But all that could change with a single fall. Here to talk about the event and to give us his take on how the Olympics have been going, Only a Game host Bill Littlefield. Bill, so nice to see you again.
A pleasure to be here, Robin.
I sweat this one out. And by the way, if on our watch anything happens, we are not going to say anything in the next few minutes about who's won, right?
Fair enough. We're
going to talk about the drama going in, because Sasha Cohen of the USA, for those who don't know, is an exquisite ballet-like skater, but she has a reputation for falling apart.
Yeah, of course, falling apart in this context has never been more relative. If she really had fallen apart, she'd have found something else to do even by now.
That's right.
She makes tiny mistakes. Right. She sometimes slips when the greatest possible number of people are watching. But it's kind of hard to imagine any skater of whom that hasn't been said at some time.
Right. Do you think the press overplays this, though? And then in turn, that impacts her skating. I mean, they've painted her into this corner.
I think the press overplays everything. They overplay arguments between teammates. They overplay judging decisions and the controversy inherent in them. That's the nature of what the Olympics has become and what sports in general on TV have become. That is the presentation of drama.
Well, in fact, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about that, because we've been yelling over the cubicle walls about this. You feel very strongly about the poor snowboarder, Lindsay. Well, I don't know, poor snowboarder. She won a silver, Lindsay Jacobellis, but she's the one who was on her way to the gold, mm-hmm. and she just got so excited she pulled up her board and fell and watched the Swiss girl speed past her and take the gold. You feel very strongly that some of the sports writers who hammered her, you know, were way out of line.
I think they're way out of line because it's really not for a sports writer to decide how an athlete should behave. I mean, certainly they can say, gee whiz, if she just kept her mind on what she was doing, she would have won a gold medal. But when she says, I goofed, I made a mistake, it happens, why can't they say, yeah, you know what? She's right. She's a kid. She was overexcited. She was exuberant. She was on the verge of winning a gold medal, and she did a little salute to the crowd, and it didn't work out the way she wanted it to.
She hoped it.
It's not the end of the world. It's not even the end of Lindsay Jacobellis. I'm sure she'll go on and snowboard magnificently for years to come.
Although some have written that they're already calling that kind of move a Jacobellis.
No, which I think is utterly unfair.
Okay. I wanted you to have time for that, but we started.
Thank you.
We started with skating. as we said, Irina Slutskaya, she's the world champion skating tonight. She was the silver medalist in 2002 to the USA's Sarah Hughes. Sarah's sister Emily is the one that got on when Michelle Kwan dropped out. So do you think this is Irina's year, or do you think Sasha, I mean, do you think, what do you think? Who's going to hold it together?
This is, of course, why they have these competitions. As
right.
you mentioned, anything can happen. And as Sarah Hughes said herself, Emily Hughes, I'm sorry, said herself quite brilliantly, you know, the ice is slippery. And so anything can happen, and that's why they have the competitions. And I'm sure lots of people, as you say, will be watching, because most people do consider this the kind of crowning event.
Right. Is there one story from the Olympics that you feel we haven't heard enough about?
Well, I have a favorite story that did appear in the news, but I haven't seen very many people talking about it. It involves Gina Kingsbury, who is a player on the Canadian women's hockey team. She and her mother were shopping in Turin before one of the games, and she was the victim of a pickpocket. And as it turned out, a particularly stupid pickpocket, because you don't want to steal the wallet of a great athlete, because she will chase you down, in this case in about 40 meters, and put her hand on
and
your shoulder and say, give
stick.
Me my wallet back. And so that's my favorite story. If you're going to be a pickpocket, don't pick an incredibly well-conditioned female athlete when you're looking for a wallet to steal.
Who could throw a puck at you? Only a Game host, Bill Littlefield. He will be covering the Olympics and other news from the world of sports. And you'll hear the stories you never hear anywhere else with Bill on his Only a Game program this weekend. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. And don't call me tonight. Don't call me tonight.
No chance.
During finger skating. More ahead here and now. upstate New York was eating out when she began choking. Kevin Stefan performed the Heimlich maneuver and saved Penny's life. Then, Kevin's mother recognized Penny as the nurse who 7 years earlier saved Kevin's life by performing CPR on him when he was hit by a baseball bat. Isn't that unbelievable? I mean, what are the chances? Well, according to a new book, better than you think. In fact, they tell a story just like that, and they say coincidences appeal to our sense of order.
1 minute you're stumbling through a quotidian chaos trying to find a phone that's ringing or maneuver a stroller up the stairs of a bus, and the next you're in a lacuna of clarity where every disparate thing, events, objects, your own thought processes appears to be bent to the same end. For a second, the suspicion that you are tiny and insignificant and the universe arbitrary and terrifying disappears. You are part of a great cosmic yes.
That's Martin Plimmer. He and Brian King co-authored Beyond Coincidence, amazing stories of coincidence and the mystery and mathematics behind them. And Martin and Brian join us from the BBC studios in London. Welcome.
Hello there. Hi there.
Well, and tell me, Brian, what is the story that you document in your book?
It happened a good few years ago now, and it involved a chap called Alan Falby, an ordinary El Paso County Highway Patrolman, and Alfred Smith, a businessman. The first time they met, Falby had an accident and was lying in the road, his legs badly injured and bleeding. And Smith came by and saw the accident and then leapt out of his car and applied a makeshift tourniquet and saved Falby's life. Falby, after recovering in hospital, returned to work. And 5 years after that, he was called to investigate an accident and arrived and found, extraordinarily, Alfred Smith lying in the road, bleeding from a leg injury, having had his own accident, and applied a tourniquet to his leg and saved his life. And as we say in the book, one good tourniquet deserves another.
You read that story, other stories in the book, the tenor who's standing in his garden singing the words, "Come to me, my love, on the wings of light." And at that moment, a female parachutist lands at his feet and he later marries her. They're amazing. But you say they happen more than we think?
Some people would say that the extraordinary thing isn't that they happened, it's that we don't notice them more often, that such are the laws of probability, that these things will happen. You wait long enough and there are enough people around for these things to happen to, they will arise, and they do.
Martin, explain the math to us.
If a coincidence happens to us and the odds are 1,000,000 to 1, it amazes us. But if you imagine all the number of things you notice every day, if you call them things happening to you, things you see in a magazine, people you spot, you look out the window, you see a bird, 1,000 things easily happen to us every day. And by a simple calculation, that means 1,000,000 things happen to us every 3 years, which means that 1,000,000 to 1 chance coincidence will happen to us every 3 years. So, you know, we should expect these things to happen. We should expect these amazing things.
Well, you write that Carl Jung was so intrigued by them that after he had a dinner with Albert Einstein, who talked about relativity and quantum mechanics, Jung wanted to create his own framework for an explanation of the world. So that's when he came up with synchronicity.
Synchronicity and an acausal connecting principle, which he came up with Wolfgang Pauli, who was a physicist.
What does that mean, and acausal?
They thought that perhaps there was a force in the universe that attracted like to like, so things which were similar would come together in some way they couldn't quite understand, but they thought that perhaps it worked a little bit like gravity.
There's a fantastic story in the book, our favourite story, I think, which demonstrates synchronicity, and it's the story of the 10-year-old Laura Buxton, who released a balloon at a party from her grandfather's garden in north of England. She put a little luggage label on it with her name and an age and address on it, and it floated 140 miles into the blue sky and landed in another garden in Wiltshire, further south in England, in the garden of another 10-year-old girl called Laura Buxton.
That's amazing.
Now, if that isn't synchronicity at work, I don't know what is.
It would also explain why Albert Rivers and Betty Cheatham sat down at a table in 1998 in Tunisia with another couple, and they introduced themselves, and the other couple's name was Albert Cheatham and Betty Rivers.
When we hear stories like the Laura Buxtons, and when these things happen to us, when something, Martin has a fantastic story, which I'll perhaps ask him, we could ask him to tell, where you think, well, that just, you know, it confounds mathematics. It's got to be something more than that.
Martin, you have experienced some of these coincidences. Tell us one.
Yes, they seem to happen to me a lot. I banged my head and I went into hospital and I was waiting for a concussion x-ray, and I went into the waiting room with my head throbbing, and there was a magazine open at the table in front of me at an article I'd written 3 years before about headaches.
The stories in the book are amazing. And I just wondered if you could, you know, we have our favorites as we've been going through. Oh, gosh, the two sisters who decide to get in the car and drive to see each other for miles apart, correct?
And, yes.
And have a head-on collision and they both die.
And they're both driving a Jeep as well.
That's a kind of a grim a coincidence. Mm. But leave us, both of you, leave us with your favorite.
I'll tell you, it's sort of a favorite. It's rather sad. But it involved the Yorkshire poet Simon Armitage, who are very famous here in England and sells very well, but was very disappointed one day when he stumbled upon a charity shop with a bin of sort of remaindered books in it. And amongst them was one of his poetry books, and it was just selling for sort of nothing, very, very cheaply. And he picked it up and thought, you know, who's rejected my book? And he opened it up and found an inscription in it, written in his own handwriting, and it said, "To Mum and Dad."
Martin?
Well, I'll tell you a happier one. It concerns a jigsaw puzzle. Stuart Spencer had been a widower for 3 years, and his daughter gave him a birthday present. She bought him a 1,000-piece jigsaw, and the jigsaw on the front had a scene of a boat, of a place where he used to love going with his wife. And she'd bought it particularly because it had this. He was nostalgic about this place. And as he was doing the jigsaw puzzle and putting it all together, he noticed that on one of the pieces, the person on the back of the boat was his wife.
Oh, coincidence.
Can I tell you one more?
Yes, go.
This is painful, this one. In June 1980, Maureen Wilcox bought tickets for both the Massachusetts and Rhode Island lotteries, and she had the winning numbers for both lotteries, but didn't win a penny. The problem was her Massachusetts numbers were the Rhode Island lottery winners, and her Rhode Island numbers were the Massachusetts lottery winners. Now, what are you going to do to deserve that?
Poor thing. Well, that's Brian King, along with Martin Plimmer. They've co-authored the book on coincidences. And by the way, for people who say you must have made this up, some of them were hard to verify, but most have been.
Yes, we put one or two in which you often see in other coincidences books simply because they have a sort of legendary status. But most of them we got from newspapers or from the horse's mouth, from people writing to us.
There is one great story which we think, as far as we can tell, and we've checked it out, seems to be true, involved a chap called Robert Lindsay, who, this is horrible, he severed his thumb in a fishing accident. He subsequently read an article about a fisherman finding a human thumb in a fish. And he checked it out and he went and saw this chap. And he says, in his own words, he said, it was in surprisingly good condition. He recognised it as being his own thumb.
I know that thumb.
And he now apparently keeps it in a jar of formaldehyde.
Martin Plimmer and Brian King, their book Beyond Coincidence. A terrific read. Thanks so much, you guys.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here.